It's almost May. Spring is upon us, and with us apparently snowstorms on Mondays and summertime by Thursday. But May is also one of my favorite times of the year because of the NBA playoffs. Anybody else an NBA fan in here? Like three of us. That's okay. We'll get together, form a support group. I know not everyone is a fan of the NBA, but I have been an avid and loyal watcher of the NBA since I was a very little kid. I remember watching Magic Johnson and Larry Bird and Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan and Charles Barkley when he was the round mound of rebound and not just the round mound. I remember Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant, and then I remember Shaquille O'Neal and Anthony Hardaway. And growing up, my friends and I, we went to all these NBA games in Atlanta at the Omni. Anybody remember the Omni? We watched Spud Webb and Dominique Wilkins and the Atlanta Hawks take on everybody from Karl Malone and the Utah Jazz to Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls. And man, were we into it. We had cards and we had these little like basketball action figures, which was kind of hilarious because the ball was glued in their hand and couldn't go anywhere. And we lined our walls with posters of these NBA players and we tried to get as many autographs as we could. One time at one of those games, one of my friends accidentally snuck his way into the visiting locker room of the Atlanta Hawks, walking around amongst reporters and coaches and trainers until finally somebody said, "I don't think that small child belongs here." And so they snatched him up and brought him back out to us, and we cheered him as a legend in our own time because he saw the inside of an NBA locker room. It seems a little silly now, but I can vividly remember so many games and experiences that felt like they were the most important thing in the world. I mean, I was moved to actual tears more than once, in anger or sadness or joy, like when John Paxson sealed the fate of the Phoenix Suns with that three-pointer from the wing, or when Michael Jordan drilled what should have been his last shot ever against the Utah Jazz. We won't talk about that Wizards thing. That didn't happen. I even remember in that Bulls-Suns game, when John Paxson hit that three, I was at my grandpa's house, and everyone was trying to get me to watch something else because they didn't like basketball. So they were trying to convince me the game's over, you should change the channel so everyone can enjoy the TV viewing experience. And I was getting super emotional when anyone would get near the TV. This was back when you had to actually walk to the TV to change the channel. And I remember shouting to anyone that would get near the TV, "It's not over! It's not over! It's not over!" And they would be like, "Okay, he's really into this." And then I remember when Paxson made the shot, I'm literally running through the house and pointing at people who doubted me and saying, "I told you! I told you! I told you! It wasn't over." It seems a little silly now, of course. Those cards and action figures are securely stored in my attic. Those memories are fading. Those championships that meant so much to me at the time. It's kind of the curse of the overzealous sports fan. You think you won the championship. You didn't do anything. Those are only still remembered by a small portion of the world, as testified to the fact that when I said the name John Paxson, many of you were like, "Who's John Paxson?" So upon reflection of my NBA fandom, I think I learned two valuable life lessons. One, it really does matter what you think is important. And two, almost everything will end and fade and be forgotten. And I think it's that realization that can either drive you to despair or to God. And it's there in that place, believe it or not, that the good news of Christianity actually does its work. That the most trivial and seemingly insignificant things can have incredible meaning if they're placed in the hands of Jesus. And that even the most so-called important things mean little to nothing if he isn't involved. I think we all, young and old, teenagers and a few more decades past that, have that thing in us that cries out and rages against sadness and disease and war and embarrassment and says, "It's not over." We long for something to give ourselves to believe in, to hope for, something that would make us great. Ecclesiastes says that God put eternity in the hearts of men. And I also believe he put it in the hearts of teenagers. I think it's why we love sports, comebacks, last-second shots. I think it's why we like romance novels and superhero movies. Echoes and shadows, everyone. Hints that it all might actually be true. That there's a story that won't end, that can't end. Until the hobbits of Middle-earth once said, "Will everything sad finally become untrue?" That's what we're doing here today. Confirmation is when we tell our children, best we can, that we're all somehow, despite our worst efforts, caught up in a grand story, and that it matters much more than we can even say. That this is also, guys, it's also a beginning and not an end. It's a first step and not a last. It's a journey full of questions and resurrection and life and death and spirit and song. With all that in mind, it's helpful to remember when you start a journey, to remember why you actually started, where you're going, and what the reason for actually leaving it all was. That's why I selected this passage in Philippians to be read today. There, the Apostle Paul is writing from prison, okay? Prison. He didn't write this from his home in Boca, from his vacation house in the Smoky Mountains. Prison. There, the Apostle Paul is writing, shackled to a guard 24 hours a day. Imagine being shackled to someone 24 hours a day. And he still manages to write this letter that is commonly called the Epistle of Joy. Paul's journey has led him to a place that everything he has and everything he was has been taken from him. Even his right to go to the bathroom by himself. And yet he is thankful, he is happy, and he is content. How? Why? Because Paul remembered why he started and he knew what to look for along the way. So this next part is for you guys. Those of you being confirmed. The rest of you can listen in. That's fine. You don't have to leave. But I believe this is what the Apostle Paul would say to you. One, this is about God. This is about God. That might seem obvious to you, but trust me when I say it's not obvious to a lot of people. Church can quickly become about what I want, what I believe, and what I think I should have. It's the primary problem with the American church and the reason that it's on life support. God is at the center of this, guys. Not me and not you and not even the Apostle Paul. And that is the good news. God is always the primary doer. He is always the initiator, the actor, the finisher of this story. And we are always the ones that respond to him. He is the hero of the story. And he is the only one worthy to be the hero of the story. In the first 11 verses of Philippians, Paul uses the name Christ 7 times. It's the very air he breathes. It's the thing that gives him joy when he has no freedom, no reputation, no money, and no health. It's the thing that also brings him trustworthy and reliable friends in this church that he writes to. That's nothing to be sneezed at, y'all. In a world where there's a bunch of fakes and a lot of throwaway relationships. And this is the thing he prays for you to know. He wants you to know this. He wants you to know that God has been and always will be with you. He was with you when you knew him and when you didn't. He was with you when you did the right thing and when you did the wrong thing. He was with you when you said yes to him and when you said no. He was with you when you hurt him and when you couldn't, when you loved him and when you ignored him. God was there. He has never, ever given up on you. He is never going to leave you, even if it feels like it sometimes. And like Paul says in this passage, he will finish what he has started in you. You have just started. Paul wants you to know that. that God did something to you. He did something in you, guys. I know it feels like sometimes that's not the truth. All this stuff, I mean, you guys went through all this material and confirmation. It can be confusing and overwhelming, and let's face it, some of it can just sound flat out nuts. Kind of crazy. And maybe it is a little crazy. But it's the kind of crazy that just might be the key to everything. To find out, though, God will have to be center stage. And not you. Some of you are looking for greatness through sports or music, Fortnite or money, dancing or basketball, karate or YouTube. Those stories will end sooner than you think. And today, if you mean it, and I don't want to sound like I'm being dramatic. I'm really not. I'm not being dramatic. The very mysteries of the universe can begin to be open to you. And in ways you probably don't realize, they're already being opened. Paul wants you to know that he believes that. He wants you to know that. In his letter to the Colossians, he says that Jesus Christ is the source of all knowledge and all wisdom. I wish I could tell you most churches believe that. That Jesus and his teachings and his life of sacrifice and love and service are what set the agenda. Here's the truth, guys. It's easy to get lost out there. And when you get lost, and you will, because the trails are not always neatly manicured everywhere you'll need to go, come back to Jesus. Come back to Jesus. Do me a favor, would you? Bring some of the church back with you. He is the door. He is the gate. He is the way to where you really want to go. This is about God. But this is also about you. Paul wants you to know it's very, very important who and what you partner with. What you attach your life to will define you and shape you in ways you cannot even see yet. It's also important that you know that Jesus' disciples, listen to this, guys, Jesus' disciples were mostly teenagers. Some as young as 13 when they first began to follow Jesus. This is why I'm talking to you like you're important. Like you have something in you that could change the world because you actually can. You get to choose, though. That's the thing about freedom. You get to choose where you'll spend your time and your energy. You get to choose where you'll spend your money. And you get to choose what you'll love and what you'll hate and whether or not God will have any part of it. Let me tell you a great lie that everyone will tell you. You're in control of your life. That couldn't be less true. The way that God made us is that we are worshiping beings. We look for things to worship, and the things we worship are the things that control our lives. The question is whether or not the things you give yourself to have the power to really change you, fulfill you, save you, and make you who you're meant to be. Maybe you don't agree with that. Maybe you don't like that. But it's the capital T truth. It's the thing I'm most sure of. You will become like that that you love. And this is why Paul prays for the Philippians and for you, that you will learn to love the things that really matter, guys. He wants you to love the things that really matter. You will grow wise in knowing the things that matter. You'll be able to see the world correctly, not blown around like a leaf on advertisements and gossip and popularity, but able to stand firm and make choices that honor others and yourself as made in the image of God. There is no higher calling for the human under the sun than that. And this is what God wants for you. Not riches, not a pain-free life, not good grades, not success in sports or school. This is not what Paul prays for you. He prays that you would know what love really is, and it would give you the wisdom to see the world the right way. It's not that those other things are bad, though. They're not. But do you have what it takes to distinguish between what's most important and what's not? That's what Paul wants you to be able to do. And can I just say, I'm sorry that we don't pray this for you more. My only excuse is that we are apt to set our sights much too low for you. That we ourselves are still being converted. That we, too, still struggle to believe all of this. That's a truth you'll have to learn as well. So Paul is there for us both. He has an audience with the sovereign Lord of the universe. He asks that you and we learn what it means to love and to overflow with wisdom. I wish I could say this is easy. I wish I could tell you it was going to be very, very easy, but it's not. You will die a thousand little deaths learning to actually live like Jesus if that's what you choose. You will learn the pain of giving up your personal preferences, of learning to put others first, and of willing to sacrifice for those you don't even like. But if you dare to try this, this love will change you in ways you never dreamed. It will make you bigger than your actual body. It will give you this strange power to forgive and love people just the way they are. It will make you great in all the ways that matter, all the ways that Jesus was, all the ways that you and all of us on this path will eventually be made anyway, if God has something to say about it. Here's the thing, guys. You've got to own it. You have to own it. Paul uses the phrase, my God, because he had to come to know God for himself, and that's up to you as well. That's the journey we're sending you on. But we don't send you alone. We're here for you. You will be tempted to believe someday that you are the only one who has sinned and is struggling and will not want to tell anyone. Don't believe it. Don't believe it. One of the greatest truths of this journey is that we all struggle, and that one of the best things we have to offer each other is not all the ways in which we are killing it and doing everything right, but all the ways in which we're broken and messed up. I believe with all my heart that the church could heal much of its disease if we actually believed that. And since we're at it, forgive us. Forgive us for not being who we needed to be for you. We have failed in ways that are inexcusable. We have allowed greed and racism and pride and arrogance to chase off many of your friends and peers. And when we are at our best, we will admit that to you. And hopefully we will ask for your help. Please be patient with us. Tell us the truth. We need you. We need you, every one of you. And the great irony in that is that the Church of Jesus Christ is still the hope of all the world. It's what Jesus himself put his hope in, and that is an encouraging thought. It's the place where when we are at our best, we become more like him. It's the one that says at the end of time, Jesus will return in great power to heal and restore all things. And on that day, it will be obvious that all the treasures marketed by filmmakers and fashion designers and video game designers and musicians and movers and shakers in business and the in crowd on campus or at school are mere trinkets that cannot last. And everyone will stand before God's throne, compelled to look into the soul-piercing eyes of God and realize he knows every shameful secret and every small deed of goodness. And there will be people on that day that will not be able to look him in the face. And there will be people that will have to squint. But there will also be people who look him dead in the face, full of joy, eyes wide open, pure and blameless, as Paul would say, not because they never did anything wrong, but because they trusted in him as the thing above all things that was worthy, the thing that would not disappoint. And they will look at each other. And hopefully, we will look at each other and we will say, I told you. I told you. I told you. That's the story we invite you into here today. That's not the end of the story. Your chapters have yet to be written. And I can't wait to see what you do with them. Make them good ones. It's not over yet. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen.